All right, options traders, listen up. I want to tell you a bit about public.com, but first, have you ever actually thought about all the fees you're paying to trade options? Aside from the regulatory fees, there are commissions, and most platforms charge per contract fees too. That's what makes today's sponsor, public.com, so interesting. Public doesn't charge commissions or per contract fees, and in an industry first, they offer a rebate of up to 18 cents per option contract traded. Check it out. If you trade 1,000 options contracts on Public, you'll get up to $180 in rebates. If you trade 10,000 contracts, you could earn almost $2,000. More importantly, the rebate means you can maximize your profits and minimize your losses. To recap, no commissions, no per contract fees, and up to 18 cents on every contract traded. See why NerdWallet recently awarded Public 5 stars for options trading and start earning up to 18 cents per contract traded only at public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. Options are not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures are in the podcast description. U.S. members only.
Welcome to Chit Chat Stocks. On this show, hosts Ryan Henderson and Brett Schaefer analyze businesses and riff on the world of investing. As a quick reminder, Chit Chat Stocks is a CCM Media Group podcast. Anything discussed on Chit Chat Stocks by Ryan, Brett, or any other podcast guest is not formal advice or recommendation. Now please enjoy this episode.
All right, welcome in. Today we do not have Ryan on the episode. He is away on a work trip, but we have two fantastic guests, two people that we've had on the show before, two people that have actually worked, well, one that still works at the Motley Fool, one that has worked in the past, and two that cover the similar types of stocks. We have Jim Gillies and Todd Wenning. Jim, you target hidden gems in your hidden gem service for Motley Fool Canada. And Todd, you have just started flyover stocks. So I guess maybe a good way to start this interview is we'll go through what both of those research services do, and then we can set up for listeners, okay, what we can learn from this episode. So Todd, what is flyover stocks? What do you target and research with that Substack?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. The flyover stock service profiles one company every month. It's not a recommendation service. It's not buy or sell. It's just finding these really interesting companies that don't have enough coverage, that aren't getting looked at, and typically are based in Midwest or outside of major cities, and so aren't usually on the Wall Street radar, right? And so we want to bring them to light, and they always have, in my opinion, economic moats and great management teams that I think investors should know more about.
All right, and Jim, you cover similar stuff at Hidden Gems. What is
sure.
that service about?
Well, Hidden Gems Canada is a small cap stock picking service. Todd will remember, going back to our days when we were both at the Motley Fool, he will remember a little service called Paydirt, which very few people actually remember anymore. I was the advisor for that. It was kind of basically small cap stocks, yeah, usually value priced, usually priced for death, that if they didn't die, they lived. Little admission here. I'm sort of running Hidden Gems Canada kind of as Paydirt 2, the sequel, whereas very much the similar strategies of what Todd is talking about here in for Flyover. We actually have a couple of overlapping stocks, but it is a formal recommendation service. So there is the buy and sells. It's one Canadian pick a month, one US pick a month, and the ongoing coverage that goes along with that. But I'm looking for the misunderstood, the unfairly beaten down, the strange stories, the special situations. I like areas where I get really bored when everyone is chasing, you know, Nvidia. Now, Nvidia is a fine company, right? I'm not, no shot at Nvidia, but you know, I'm going to add precisely zero value to any discussion of Nvidia. But I might add some value to a discussion of insert hidden gem's name here. So that's where I'm going. I'm a little more, I think, eclectic than your average fool. And I'm fine with that. So,
yeah, I think the rule of thumb for both you guys is if they're covering it on CNBC, maybe I need to search elsewhere. But you guys have overlapping strategies here in the companies that you're writing about. And I think to kick off the conversation, a good question is, why? Why do you think there is value in looking at underfollowed companies? Maybe Jim, we'll start with you this time.
There's value in following underfollowed companies because they're underfollowed, because they may be too small to attract. I know it's a tautology, right? But because they're too small to attract Wall Street's interest, or they're misunderstood, or there's something that has just driven people off, or it might just be we know that spinoffs, for example, Joel Greenblatt has talked about spinoffs, Peter Lynch has talked about spinoffs, Seth Klarman, about how they are mechanisms for driving. In aggregate, not everyone, I can give you some ones that have just been terrible, but in aggregate, spinoffs drive excess profits, at least in the early going. And then if you've also freed a great management team, to steal from Todd there a minute ago, if you freed a great management team with an economic moat from a larger entity, you know, that can be beautiful, right? But it's looking for the things that are off other people's radar, because you can generally get it at a better price, better valuation. You can see what's going on. And then also you get the underfollow tends to also be not one-to-one, but correlated with smaller. And that again is, you know, if you're running a $25 billion hedge fund and we're talking about a $200 million market cap company, I mean, how much can you buy to move the needle at your fund? So you're probably going to avoid it. So, and that's for individual investors, for small cap investors, that's gravy.
And Todd?
Yeah, think about what Bill Miller has said. I believe it was Bill Miller who said this in the past, that you have three opportunities to outperform. One's informational, one's analytical, and one's behavioral. And I would say for most large cap, well-covered companies, the only opportunity you have is behavioral. There's some situations where maybe you understand the large cap company better than some of the analysts. So for example, Costco, you may have had a unique perspective on it that wasn't well understood by the street. But most of the time, I think the story is pretty well known. With smaller companies that are underfollowed, it's just not enough people have turned the stone in their hand, right? And done a look at it and try to figure out what exactly does this company do? Are they doing something different? Like we, for example, looked at a company, stocks. I keep saying we, but right? Flyover stocks. But we looked at Flyover stocks. We looked at a company called Hawkins, one analyst on the sell side, and is doing this really interesting business with water treatment services. And they have this great operating model where they are investing heavily in it. And it's this hub and spoke model. And it's just not really in the street. I mean, there's no one doing research on Hawkins right now besides one person. And it's not a major brokerage firm. So those are the sort of situations that I just light up over, because those are situations that have not been talked about enough in the market and could really benefit investors, especially if there's a pullback in the stock or if they get a good, better understanding of what the stock should be trading for and what a good range is, and try to find if there's a pullback in them, maybe take a starter position, learn more about them.
And do you guys... So for, I think a lot of individual investors, they get in trouble with, at least at the start, and especially over the last 5 to 10 years, with going heavy into just, you know, 100% growth stocks, a lot of stuff correlated to the same, you know, NASDAQ 100, technology basket, all the stuff that's talked about on CNBC. Do you guys think about, you know, having these type of stocks as maybe uncorrelated to the broader market movements, something that's not going to be super extremely volatile, or maybe they will be volatile. I'm not sure. Is that part of the thinking when it goes into making these or, you know, adding these stocks to your research service? Either you can go first.
I'll take a swing. The amount of time I spend worrying about correlating with broader market or volatility is precisely zero. It's just not something that I particularly care about. That may or may not be a good thing. I'm not saying that's the right way to be. It's just something that I've never, it doesn't bother me, but I'm also, I'm unafraid of looking stupid for a while. I know what my own track record is. A lot of it is public for various fool services. And believe me, I have had great opportunity to look stupid on names for lengthy periods of time, but my overall record's pretty good, and so it doesn't bother me as long as I am getting to really touch down with management. That's another thing about a lot of the small cap stuff. you can get management on the horn pretty easily if you have a question. And in fact, sometimes they may call you as well. Now that could be a dangerous sign because they might be trying to spit a story out there. And I've got examples of that too. But you have that ability to get in at the business level and say, okay, this retail concept, they seem to be stumbling. How many stores are they doing? Should they be shutting down stores? Should they really be investing in new stores because the ROIC might not be there? You can start getting, I think, a little bit, more granular that way. Maybe that falls into Todd's behavioral advantage that, you know, that I'm just, you know, or I'm
being. Yeah. And I know, yeah, when we get either a DM on Twitter or an email from a company asking for them to either have their CEO or CFO on or for us to promote their stock, that's all right. Well, maybe we should check that one off the list. But Todd, any thoughts on that before we get into the next topic here?
Pew, pew, sound the alarms. We have a new sponsor alert. That's firmreturns.com. It's a stock research blog. Our friend runs that, and it has covers companies from all around the globe, but it leans really more towards the UK as that's his home market, and it gives him easier access to management, and he provides ongoing updates on the companies that he's invested in, as well as an archive of longer form write-ups that you can access all for free. There is a paid tier, but there is tons of free content out there. And these reports are very thorough. To give you an example of just how thorough some of these are, at one point he was digging into a company's account, and for one company he wrote up recently, he actually managed to find a material misstatement that had been missed by the auditors, and management reached out and confirmed the error to him.
And these are companies of all different sizes, from all different sectors and all different markets around the globe, but with a focus on his home market in the United Kingdom.
If you want to check this out, firmreturns.com, like I said, tons of free content on the website. If you're interested in one of the paid plans, you can go to firmreturns.com/chitchat. That's firmreturns.com/chitchat, and it'll get you 20% off.
Well, I certainly agree that you have a lot more access to management as a small investor. So, you know, just being able to ask a question, like if you try to do that with Starbucks, you're probably not going to get an answer, or you'll get the very lowest analyst or the investor relations analyst, sending you a quick email back. You're not going to get a lot of in-depth time, especially when in the C-suite. So having, it can help you certainly from your education perspective as well. If you're a younger investor, just getting access to anyone on the C-suite is a great opportunity. I'm a teacher at University of Dayton, and I help the students. And we just started talking with management teams. That's one thing that I've been trying to start with. And we had one that came through an alumni network. And I thought that we should be doing this more often. We should be talking with management teams because it's a great education opportunity for them to speak with someone who's in charge or at least in an area of influence in a major public company.
No, yeah, that makes sense. I totally agree. Now, let's go into the actual business qualities you guys are looking for, because when I look at, or when anyone looks at all the companies out there that are not, you know, $100 billion market cap, well, especially if you go international, there are thousands upon thousands of ones that an investor could look at. And obviously you can't buy 1,000 stocks in your portfolio. That would be certifiably insane. What are the qualities that you guys are looking for that, and you know, this could be, you can toss in any historical example that comes to mind here, where a flyover / hidden gem, you know, is set up to put up strong returns over the long haul. What are some of the key tenets to a good flyover stock? Maybe Todd, can start here.
Yeah. I think, so what really got me hooked on this idea was Tractor Supply. That sort of my origin story with coming around to this, this flyover stock kind of mindset. And so back in my Motley Fool days, I'm working on Motley Fool Pro with our mutual friend, Jeff Fisher. We looked at Tractor Supply. This was around the fall of 2008. And I started doing these screens and things were starting to sell off. And so I'm looking through and I keep seeing this name Tractor Supply pop up on all of my screens, all my quality screens. I'm like, this is like a farming equipment company. I'm not interested in that. But it kept popping up enough where I started, okay, I'm gonna take a closer look. And I started digging in. I thought, wow, this is really neat. This is a sort of hobby farming retail concept that is based in Tennessee, well outside of Wall Street's normal routine. and it just wasn't being. And we had an opportunity to buy it in early March 2009, and we waited, and the stock just ramped up. We completely lost it. But that to me just was a great example of what a flyover stock can be, where you have this tremendous retail concept or just a general franchise in general, but that's not well understood. That's not on the regular Wall Street beat that can continue to grow. And all of a sudden everyone takes notice going, wow, they're growing 10% units every single year. Let's take a look at this. And then eventually it gets large enough where the institutions begin to start buying it, and then it can really ramp up. And I think Tractor Supply, I don't even know how much it's up since March 2009, but thousands percent would be my guess. I mean, it's just been a huge winner. And Jack Henry is another example of that. Just based in Monett, Missouri, population 10,000, one of the best banking software companies in the country. And again, one of those best performing companies over the last 25, 30 years.
So it's funny that Todd brings up Tractor Supply. I mentioned Paydirt earlier. Round about the same time that Todd was looking at it, Paydirt ran until it's very short life, you know, pour one out for Paydirt. Turns out, you know, when you're trying to sell small cap value during a global financial crisis, it's real hard to sell. It's because people, you know, won't buy Starbucks at $4 or Home Depot at $19. They're sure not going to buy your price for death crap. But we actually put Tractor Supply on our scorecard, sort of. We put it on the Paydirt scorecard, but as a watchlist company, we had the ability to do watchlist only, meaning we would come back to it later. We never got the chance to, of course, because the service was closed down. But Tractor Supply, I mean, I'm just going to go all fanboy on Tractor Supply for a moment. This is Todd's fault. About a year ago in Hidden Gems Canada, I recommended Boot Barn, which was a company I'd never heard of until another fool analyst named Emily Flippin brought it up. And I was captivated by the idea of, first of all, the name is absurd. I have a weakness for absurd names. Okay. Anyone remember Dress Barn?
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah, no. You know,
I think they went for Ascena Retail, and they put Justice and Maurice's and Dress Barn and a couple other concepts together and levered it up and ran it into the ground and destroyed generational wealth. So it's not it's a cautionary tale. But Dress Barn as a publicly traded individual company was a fantastic name. And I'm just like, you know, what do you say to your wife? Hey, honey, I'm going to take you out, buy something nice. Let's go to Dress Barn. How are you not sleeping on the couch for the next week, right? But anyway, but no, Tractor Supply Company, I had the opportunity when I was recommending Boot Barn to revisit some of my notes and stuff on Tractor Supply and going back to the time that Todd's talking about it and also updating the spreadsheet. And it just made me weep because this is of a year ago, Todd, but it's probably more recent than your pro stuff. And you know, we both work on either side of Jeff. The 25 year return for annualized return for Tractor Supply Company, this niche hobby farmer, you know, flyover stock. I love that term. 25.1% annualized, 25.8% annualized if you want to have dividend reinvestment, which is really just, you know, the cherry on the sundae. Absolutely murdered the market return with the Magnificent Seven or the Menomina stock, whatever we're calling them. This is a company that sells chicken coop wire.
Right. And I guess the question I have and a lot of listeners might have is, what are the specific qualities that Tractor Supply had? Is it that, you know, they're based in Tennessee? It's something that is not going to be popular in New York City or San Francisco where, you know, and maybe Toronto too, where all the analysts are like, what is that? I don't know. I never interact with this. Is that some of the qualities that can help, you know, lead to long-term just crushing the market, but no one really cares? Because I think it's just a fascinating dichotomy where you have this stock that's doing so well. The market cap now is sizable, $27 billion. And I guess he does get some coverage among the bigger financial news places now. But why do you think Tractor Supply, you know, as you mentioned, Jim, just absolutely done so well over the long term, but no one really seems to care? Like, because I think that's where, you know, a listener can look and say, hey, I can look for these qualities in maybe another company down the line.
Todd, you want to start? Jim, go ahead first.
Okay, I'll take a story. Todd might remember his notes better than, because I'm just reading what I wrote a year ago, which wasn't focusing on the tactics so much, but it's cash flows, reasonable valuation, and something that we all give lip service to, but I often wonder that how many people are actually doing the work. Like, okay, it's not enough just to generate free cash flow. Okay. You have to have management with a talent and an eye and an ability to reinvest that free cash flow for the betterment of shareholders or to otherwise allocate it. Like maybe I know we've talked about Windmark before, Brett, on this show. One of my all-time favorite companies, long-term hold there, fantastic management. They do not have the ability to reinvest their cash flows into the business. They don't. Okay. So what do they do with it? Well, they either pay back debt when they have some, or they will buy back stock. But I'm talking to the CEO. He's flat out said to me, we know what our stock is worth, or we think it's worth. We won't buy above a certain price. Like, you know, he's very direct. I mean, he won't tell me the price, of course, and he shouldn't. But like, you know, just the fact that a management team values their stock and does the Buffett thing of we will buy back when X, we will not buy back when Y. So what they do with all their excess capital is they pay it out as a very nice regular dividend and a very generous special dividend quite often when they have the excess cash. And so with Tractor Supply, it's cash flows and the ability to open new stores with returns on invested capital that are far in excess of their cost of capital. And just basically the ability to sit back and not do much of anything. I'm not a big growth guy. Growth is an input to valuation in my book. I'm very on the spectrum of valuation doesn't matter to valuation is the only thing that matters. I'm pretty close to this end. And so I'm a stickler for valuation. So when I screen for things like this and like Todd, I've had Tractor Supply pop up, not so much in my small cap screens anymore because, you know, size. But you know, you do think like I'm just looking for like moderate growth. If you're over 5%, I'll look at you. You know, with slowly increasing margins, reasonable leverage, good cash flow, and then you start doing some. Once you have everything, you can start doing your work of how have they done their capital allocation work, and that it's amazing how many great opportunities a very simple screen comes up. Todd.
Yeah, there was Tractor Supply from a qualitative perspective had a couple of things going for it that I don't think were well understood or at least well enough appreciated by the market when it was growing. One was that it had a fantastic corporate culture. And there's a book out that was written by the company, I believe, but just talking going back through the history. And there was an article by the CEO, Hal Lawton, where he talks about how he talked to the previous three CEOs of Tractor Supply and all of them just wanted to talk about the culture. That's what it was all about. And it's this sort of kind of down home, you know, be really nice to your customers, be there for them when things are rough for them, and they'll pay you back many times over the course. And so like, they want to know your name the next time you come in the store, not the first time, but second time, just things like that, where, you know, this retail experience. The other thing is that I think a lot of investors probably thought, well, Home Depot is just going to do this. Well, Home Depot tried it, but people weren't going to Home Depot to get chicken coop, right? Or chicken coop wire, right? They were going to get their hardware and, you know, things like that. And it wasn't really what they were after. So what really separates Tractor Supply is their livestock feed and animal feed. So these are for, again, hobby farmers. This is not large scale corporate farming. This is a guy with a couple of acres and doing some homesteading and, you know, need some stuff for the chicken coop and for the garden. And for the lawn, but they also have, I think there's some crazy numbers out there, and Jim might know them off the top of his head, but, you know, I think like half of their customers have horses or something like that. Wow.
That was the tie-in with the boot barn, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. So they all have something that, you know, is not your common consumer, right? That people aren't really thinking about. And so there was actually the best moat case I've ever seen for Tractor Supply was by the FTC. So when Tractor Supply tried to buy Orscheln, I think it was a couple of years ago, the FTC sued Tractor Supply for antitrust. And you think, for a retailer, there's no possible way that there would be antitrust in retail. But just the issue is with e-commerce, it's not economical for Amazon to ship this heavy, low value material to people the next day. So if you need to, you know, feed your dog or feed your chickens or whatever, you know, those bags of feed are $30, or you might need 6 or 8 bags of them. And there's no way that Amazon or Walmart price effectively send these things out to rural areas. But Tractor Supply is spread out enough now. They have enough retail locations where they're the only game in town. And so it's crazy that they had to spin off or divest some of the stores they acquired, because you would think retail is just set up one next door and you can compete it away. But there's clearly something that Tractor Supply is doing that is hard to replicate by anybody else. That was an example of, you know, how a company that's in a flyover country can create a moat and grow very rapidly by doing things that nobody else seems to do, by specializing in niche and really executing very well by having a great corporate culture.
Okay. And I want to do another example. This is one that we've talked about before. I believe one of them is headquartered in Cincinnati, where Todd, you are located. So I think that'll be a fun one as well. It's Medpace. Just for some numbers here, it has a 1300, well, when I put the notes in, total return of 1300% versus the S&P 500 at just 171% since they've been public. And I'm guessing, you know, I never heard of this company, and I'm guessing a lot of the listeners haven't heard of them. Why is that? You know, why have the returns been so good, but no one actually talks about it? Todd, maybe you can start. Yes, here.
Todd should go first, because I'm going to go on for a long time on this one.
Yeah, Medpace, I came around to too late. So Jim knows them a lot better than me, but they are actually, they're based in Madisonville here in Cincinnati. And I went to a CFA Institute Society meeting like about 6 or 7 years ago now, and went to this really nice hotel, and it's kind of right next to this office park. And I was like, why is this nice hotel here? And someone at the meeting said, you know, it's mm-hmm. Medpace's CEO. He built this because, so they do clinical research outsourcing. And so these are small and mid-sized biotech companies that need someone to take their molecule through the clinical research process, and they don't have the resources to do it internally, so they outsource it to Medpace. There's a couple different competitors there, but Medpace specializes in the small and medium-sized biotechs. And when these executives are flying into Cincinnati, you know, Madisonville is about 10 miles from downtown, and there weren't many nice hotels out there. So the guy built, August Trundle, built a hotel, turned it from a warehouse into a like luxury hotel. And you know, for some reason, I never clicked my mind, pay attention to this, because this is interesting, right? And so there, every time I turn around, I drive through Madisonville, and the place is just growing, 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 growing. They're just adding more jobs and, you know, reinvesting in the community and just doing a really nice job. So I started doing some research into it, and I thought, well, I don't really understand biotech. I'm just going to take a pass on it, put in the too hard pile. But once I started digging into it, it's not terribly difficult to understand how their business works. And so, you know, August Trundle, he just seems like a guy, from everything I've read, who has just like a nose for value. You know, he's got things, if you looked at party transactions and things, he's buying back stock at really attractive prices. He's got these different operations where he owns the land that they're building on. So he's got all these different things, and he's thinking about, how do I make value out of the capital that I have? And so, you know, the company's buying back stock at really opportunistic prices. He's buying back stock at opportunistic prices. And you start, maybe I should start paying attention to this a little bit more. And so I've had some time to speak with them. I haven't talked with the CEO, but I've talked with the CFO. And just a really impressive company. And there are very few companies out there who I say what the phrase I use is get it. And Medpace gets it in terms of capital allocation. And yeah, this very, very impressive company.
100%.
This seems to be a theme here, that, you know, an overlapping theme that, you know, management's understanding capital allocation. And I guess I was going to ask this later, but I want to ask it now since you guys have mentioned it multiple times, is, you know, with these undervalued followed stocks, it seems like the valuations are always sometimes permanently depressed because it doesn't get, you know, going through the hype cycle. Is a management team taking advantage of that? Very important to you guys when, you know, finding stuff that passes the sniff test?
It's an added bonus for me. I'll put it that way. Like, if you pass the sniff test, maybe I'll recommend or own you regardless. But if you then demonstrate management gets it, which I think is, you know, we're going to say about 17 times, I think, for the rest of the show, because that is a bonus. Yeah. Todd's given a good overview of what MedPace is. I will say they do more than just the small biotech. They do medical devices. They do CR contract research for large pharma companies as well. Like they are very much specializing as well in the small as well. What is really interesting to me, and yeah, so MedPace is a 2-time hidden gem rec. I think recommended in March 2020, so that was good timing. Because we got it for sub $70. And the second time is a bit different. It's going to tie into the capital allocation, so I'll come back to that. But one of the things when I found MedPace, I'd never heard of it. And then I start reading through the proxy statement. I start seeing they have the hotel there, which Todd is talking about. They have, Dr. Trundle owns an air, travel services company, private aviation company, we'll call it. Guess who handles the travel for MedPace? Even like the buildings and stuff, as Todd says, the lease buildings are leased from Trundle's family. And look, some people might get turned off by that because Trundle's got multiple ways to double dip into the thing. But then you actually watch the company as well and how he handles his money. And as Todd says, Dr. Trundle very much has a nose for value. You start to realize, yeah, he's not taking advantage of the company. And I've got two examples I want to throw out here. This is from the 2018 proxy statement, a year where operating income, again, remember, Dr. August Trundle is the founder of the company. He is the founder and CEO. The company was founded in 1992. He's the only CEO the company has ever had, okay? Through small startup, private, got passed around through private equity a bunch of times, IPO'd in 2016, I believe. Been public ever since. They bought out, when they came public, they still had some private equity overhang. They bought those guys out, then did nothing with capital allocation for a few years, let the cash pile up on the balance sheet until we start getting into 2020. But in the 2018 proxy, so he's the largest shareholder, Dr. Trundle, he's the CEO and founder. This is a man who, if he wanted to, could put his thumb on the scale. From the 2018 proxy statement, where operating income grew 56%, earnings per share doubled, and the company produced $139 million in free cash flow. In the proxy statement, always read your proxy statement, kids, stated that Dr. Trundle was, quote, eligible for a discretionary bonus for attainment of individual and company performance goals, end quote. This statement is immediately followed in the proxy by the terse comment, quote, for 2018, our board, chaired by Dr. Trundle, our board determined to not provide Mr. Trundle with a cash bonus, end quote. Again, operating earnings up 56%, earnings per share doubled, swimming in cash. What did the man need to do to get a bonus? I do wonder. But again, then you say, well, he owns a hotel and like, he's fine. Like there's no tag days for August Trundle, right? And another thing that I thought was really interesting when all of this sets, when you're investing, it's almost like long-term relationships. You learn more about the companies. You learn more about the people involved. Sometimes you wish you didn't learn more about the people involved, but you learn more and you see how people act or see people talk. I mean, I suppose we call that culture. Todd certainly has talked about, about the Tractor Supply story, which again, like it was always the culture. Company IPOs in 2016, usually an IPO is either you're raising money for growth, right? Or it's insiders cashing out. Very rare is it when the CEO and founder of the company, as he's IPOing, buys shares. Yet Dr. Trundle put $20 million of his own money into the IPO at the IPO price. He's already the largest beneficiary of what's going on, but he was a buyer at the IPO, not a seller. I submit to you that's rare.
Right. That's a nice note. That's a good indication that he gets it.
as well, you guys have been saying.
And then further on the subject of getting it, I mentioned that MedPace is a 2-time hidden gem recommendation. Okay. And Todd will remember from, you know, from the Fool days, you know, like all these frontline services, you know, it's 2 picks a month and every 6 months you do a review issue where you do a re-recommendation, it's scheduled, blah, blah, blah. I made MedPace my only unscheduled re-recommendation. Because I'm at the time, I think it was August 2022. I'm like, this is literally my best idea. My review issue is not until December or whatever. Like, do I not go with my best idea? And so I said, I hope you will indulge me. I think we got it on the scorecard a second time at $140. But my rationale was this, and it was almost exclusively on these guys get it. Because the 3 or 4 quarters prior to that, every time they reported perfectly good numbers, like they were... There's nothing wrong with it. The stock would get whaled 15%. And I'm like, I don't get it. And then coming into 2022, I mentioned again, you know, we talk about management's getting it. MedPace hadn't done anything with it. They just built their cash on the balance sheet, did nothing with it. Coming into 2022, they blew the whole thing buying back stock, and they took on some debt to buy back some stock. That can be dangerous if you're a company named Sleep Number. But if it's not Sleep Number, it's a shot at another Midwestern company. Sorry, Sleep Number, but you did it twice. Deep cut. But these guys, they started buying back their own stock aggressively in the first 2 quarters of 2022. And they bought back 14% of the shares. They exhausted their cash hoard from the previous 4 years, 5 years. They took on a bit of debt. By the way, that debt's now gone. They paid it all back, so it's fine. They reduced their share count by 14% in the first 2 quarters. Third quarter, so starting in July of 2022, Dr. August Trundle, founder and CEO, starts buying back or buying stock for himself. And he put $155 million of his own money into his own stock in less than 3 months. Again, he's already the largest shareholder. The company has already bought back 14%. And I'm saying to my team, in one of our investment meetings, I'm like, they don't ring a bell at the bottom. But sometimes they ring a bell at the bottom. Like, you know, this guy's making a big bet both professionally and personally. And here's the valuation numbers. They look good. Like I said, the 3 or 4 quarters before where they gotten whaled every time they reported, it looked fine. Like they talked a little bit about, well, you know, maybe the request for proposals down a little bit, maybe some biotech funding might be down 5%, but it's not filtering. Like if you read the conference call transcripts, everything looked actually good and the stock gets slammed. So I re-recommended it in August 2022. And I basically went through the whole valuation argument, went through the whole capital allocation that they get it. October 2022 comes along, Q3 earnings come out, stock goes up 38% in a day. It's like finally the market goes, oh yeah, there's good stuff happening here. And it hasn't looked back since. Like I said, I think that was about 135 or 145, I think the second time. I think it closed yesterday at 405 or 410.
Yeah, I'm seeing 412. Oh, I got to load it up
there,
here.
There you go. Okay. So, you know, so it's you know, so if you're in at 70 and you're in at 140 and now it's 412, you know, in less than 4 years, barely 4 years, I guess, from the first one. That does good things for your personal portfolio if you were following along with us. So
earlier in the show, you heard us talk about the investing platform, public.com. That's where you can trade options with no commissions or per contract fees, and you get a rebate of up to 18 cents per contract. NerdWallet recently gave Public 5 out of 5 stars for options trading. If you want to see why, go to public.com and start getting a rebate of up to 18 cents per contract traded. This is paid for by Public Investing. Options are not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures are in the podcast description. U.S. members only. FinChat.io is the complete stock research platform for fundamental investors. They have all the standard financial data on more than 100,000 stocks globally. And beyond that, they have company-specific segment and KPI data on more than 1,500 stocks. So to give some examples here, you want to see Netflix's average revenue per member over the last 10 years? They've got it. You like to track YouTube's advertising revenue? They've got that too. If you want to see Celsius's revenue that comes from Costco, how much of their revenue comes from Costco? they also have that. So the breadth of FinChat segment and KPI data truly is one of a kind. I use FinChat every day to track and manage all my investments. I also use it to discover new investments. And if you want to get 15% off any paid plan, go to finchat.io/chitchat. That's finchat.io/chitchat to get 15% off any paid plan. The link will also be in our show notes.
Okay, let me invert it.
Please.
How do you disqualify a company? As we mentioned, there's thousands of small caps out there. I know you guys mentioned management is important. Maybe that's important here as well. What if you look at a company or you're researching one and you go, you see these two things or these three things, and you go immediately, no, this is not for me. What are they? Todd, maybe we can start with you.
For me, it's my three key things are, part of my philosophy, are moat, management, and price. Those are the three things that have to come together for me to be interested. So if any one of those things doesn't fall into place, I pass on the idea. So if it's just price, I'll keep the name on my watch list. I won't buy it, but I'll be interested and keep it on the watch list. For me, it really comes down to moat. Is it has to have a moat. That's the number one thing for me. And so if I can't figure out why this company has a dirt advantage, if I can't put it into one of the five Morningstar buckets or think through what might prevent someone from doing just what this company's doing with a little bit more money, a little more capital, I take a pass on it. Because sometimes you'll see some companies with, you know, maybe a narrow moat, but it's kind of temporary. It's based on some secular tailwinds or cyclical tailwinds that they have, but can't really pinpoint what it is that makes them special. Like if they disappeared tomorrow, what would their customers miss? That's a question I always ask. And so sometimes I can't answer that pass. If it just doesn't strike me as invested in the company, not just financially, but personally, in terms of, are they passionate about this? If there's just a revolving door of CEOs, CFOs, what I call mercenary executives, or, you know, paid managers, right? That's what I want to avoid.
Consultant, right. Yeah. Like, we call them the consultant brands, right. Yeah.
I want to see people who maybe they're just starting. Maybe they have a small ownership stake. That's not completely disqualifying to me, where a management team only owns like 1% of the company collectively or something. That's not terrible for me. I won't pass based on that alone. I like to see a little bit more than that. But if it's a new team or a new group coming in, what I'm looking for there is just, are they passionate about what they're doing? And looking at their track record, have they been with the company for a long time? If there's a lot of external hires, that's concerning to me, because, you know, and that's one of the things with Costco, a new CFO coming in from outside was a little confusing to me, right? Because I like to see companies with great corporate cultures promote from within, because you don't have to sell them on the culture. Right. So when I see a lot of external hires, that usually strikes me as, you know, something is wrong. And the board says we need to bring in some fresh blood to new perspective on the business. And I should disclose, I'm not sure what your disclosure policies are, but I own Costco and Tractor Supply, my personal accounts. Those are the only two that I've mentioned so far that I own. But those are the major things that I look for, a moat and management perspective. Price. You know, some of the recommendations, or not recommendations, I shouldn't say that, because the profile of the names I've profiled on Flyover Stocks is they're overvalued at the time. And I'm just like, you know, this is a great company to keep on your watch list. I don't own it. I don't think you should own it at this price. It's up to you if you want to. But, you know, this is, you know, not a great perhaps time to buy it, but it's a great company to know. And so that's sometimes when there is just a price issue, you can just keep it on the watch list, but you don't have to buy it.
Okay, Jim, anything to add?
I love what Todd has said. I love the concept of moats. I think I'm kind of bad at identifying moats sometimes. So, you know, but I aspire to be better at identifying moats. Oddly, I don't have a problem buying companies without moats. So we'll call it a cyclical or what have you. Like, oil company A's oil is not somehow specialty branded better than oil company B's, right? So I will play in that pool. I think that what disqualifies me probably the most, or disqualifies a company for me, I should say, is when I do like reading proxy statements. I do like reading. I know it's a sickness, but reading proxy statements, reading conference call transcripts, and comparing, and this is how I know we're going to have some job security kind of thing, right? Because this is not easily done. Like the implications is not easily done throwing it into an AI generator. It's like, you know, but like just matching, like, has management actions followed what they said they were going to do? It sounds simple, right? But like, did management have they have like? I'll give you an example. It might not be the most popular example, but I know Todd knows who Sardar Biglari is, and I think Sardar, he's a nice guy. I've met him several times, but you know, he very famously, when he was making an activist campaign to take over Steak and Shake, which then he was successful and became part of what is now known as Biglari Holdings. And it's very important that we have the portrait of Sardar Biglari in the front foyer of every Steak and Shake out there. But too cynical? Oh, sorry. But, you know, he was very famously talking about, I'm going to get a nasty message, but he was very famously talking about, you know, that his interest in, because he went after Western Sizzlin first and then Friendly Ice Cream and actually acquired Western Sizzlin, helped really affect change at Friendly Ice Cream, and then went after Steak and Shake. And his whole thing was, to the message to other people, you know, individual investors who might buy and vote for Sardar when the proxy statement came. That, you know, wanted to make money with you, not off of you. Okay. And then, so, and he won the day at Steak and Shake and got in, became chairman of the board, became CEO, and then ultimately folded it into the greater Biglari Holdings empire. But along the way, all of a sudden the salary went from 200,000 to 900,000. And along the way, there was a licensing agreement where, he signed with himself, about himself, for the name Biglari Holdings, which has no historical name for this very classic flyover company in Steak and Shake. There's a good book on that, Selling Steak Burgers, as well, which I think is on the shelf behind me somewhere, just about the story of Steak and Shake pre-Sardar. And then there was an incentive package that was hedge fund-esque. You know, 20, it was very Buffett-esque, but still it was 25% of any book value gain above 6%, you know, and Sardar has made millions, you know, okay, that's fine. Like, you know, he's followed the rules and he owns a good chunk of the shares in the Lion Fund, which is part of his whole empire. But I encourage you to look up the performance over the past 5 and 10 years vis-a-vis the market. And, you know, what he did didn't match what he said. And I was a Steak and Shake owner. I've owned it in the past. I think I've been out since 2013. So quite a long time because of that. And some of the names we talked about, you know, MedPace, Tractor Supply, you know, they got it. And, you know, and I'll say more that Sardar got his. But like, and then as well, Todd talks about, you know, about management. You know, do they have a passion for the business? I'm not getting paid to say this, right? But I occasionally get to talk to various people, various companies. I would encourage either of you at some point, get Brett Heffes, if he'll talk to you. But Brett Heffes, the CEO of Windmark. I'm not sure I've heard someone with as much passion for their business recently. I mean, he's the one that's made the most impression on me, and I've talked to him a couple of times, including an episode of another podcast on the Motley Fool banner from, I think, last July, where it was a fantastic conversation, completely held up by him, on Motley Fool Money. But like, they're the business of resale. They're the parent company of Play It Again Sports, Once Upon a Child, Plato's Closet, Style Encore, Music Go Round. They're a franchisor of used goods. This is not a business that a lot of people would say, you know, I'm so excited to own this. But I challenge you to listen to that. I'm sorry, this is bad form. I challenge you to listen to that podcast from last July. If you can get Brett Heffes on the show, Brett, or Todd, you talk. Like, And it's a Minnesota base, St. Paul, Minnesota. So, you know, there's your flyover country. You know, I've not heard someone who is as passionate about a business that I think a lot of people would write off because, you know, if Brett's listening, he's probably not listening, but if Brett's listening, sorry, Brett, you know, it's not a sexy business.
Yeah.
But you will talk to him, or you will hear him talking, and you'll go, this guy gets it, to use our parlance. And I think he's an evangelist for the stock. I think he's an for the company. I shouldn't say for the stock. I don't think he cares about what the stock price does. But that guy has a sense of passion and purpose for that business that is, I think, outstanding to behold.
Okay. What are some telltale signs of a dishonest management team? Because I've just spending some time looking at small and micro caps, it seems like, and yeah, you know, there's dishonest management teams in the large cap and mega cap space as well, but seems like it can be prevalent in the underfollowed companies. It's kind of the downside of looking at something that isn't as heavily covered. What are some of the telltale signs that a management team might not be either telling you the truth or misleading you or all that good stuff? Jim, it seems like
you're going to get me in trouble, man.
Yeah, maybe.
We'll Todd, over to you.
Yeah, if we don't need to use specific examples, just if we don't want to.
I will use a couple of examples. I'll leave the ticker out, and then I'm hoping Todd's going to rescue me. I've already mentioned one with Big Larry Holdings. Not dishonest, but just interest disaligned with that of outside shareholders. I'm going to put it that way. I have had, again, read your proxy statements, read your conference call transcripts, compare subsequent actions to what they tell you they're going to do. If you start seeing a pattern where it's consistently they're saying one thing and doing another, that's probably not great. Refusal to admit, like, I think a superpower, one of my core philosophies, this is a terrible philosophy to have, but one of my core philosophies is that most people will do almost anything. They will sever familial relationships. They will end marriages. They will torpedo jobs. People will do almost anything to avoid admitting they are wrong. And so in the spirit of invert, always invert, I think admitting you're wrong is a superpower. I've had some absolutely amazing investing returns from companies where they say, hey, we screwed up. Hey, we did this wrong. And here's how we're going to do it now. I can give you one that was a 60 bagger that it's gone now, was acquired. But, you know, I found it at $1.15 US. It was Canadian and US cross listed. I paid the Canadian price, but, you know, it's exchange rates are what they are. But it was about $1.15 US at the time I found it. And it was taken out. I think I found it in 2005. And it was taken out in 2014 at $61.50 a share. And I got interested because the company, they had been spending all this money developing a side project or something. And then in one quarter, it went away. They just, we've gassed that project and we're acquiring this other company that basically does what the, so they made the make buy decision and they said, we're going to make it. Nah, screw that. We're going to buy it. We're going to buy competitors. Basically they said we were wrong what we were doing. And I'm like, well, that's interesting. Like anytime you, pardon me? Oh, so it would say, so when, you know, but companies that can't admit they're wrong, that's a warning sign. So I can give you a company that, again, I'm going to try to not be specific, stay away. But like was in these two kind of complementary, you know, I'm going to say subprime finance opportunities areas. And they made an acquisition in kind of a one alongside that, you know, initially looked like, okay, well, they're in sector A and sector B, and sector C is kind of adjacent to that. So it seemed like a good expansion. So they bought it, and then very quickly, everything went to hell. You know, like they had like their loss rate was like you know, capital out the door that never comes back because they were in a subprime lending, subprime finance area. Their loss rate on this new division they'd bought was at 50%, 50. And I don't care what rates you're charging as a subprime usurist financier. If you are losing 50 cents on every dollar walking out the door, that's going to be a disaster. And I had the opportunity to talk to management. And they just absolutely refused to acknowledge that there was a problem. No, and I'm like, but I'm like walking them through. Like, I can see you. It's like you, when my kids were like 4 years old, right? And we're playing hide and seek and they're under a blanket, but the blanket's moving. And I'm like, I can see what you're doing. Like, just admit you're wrong and then say how you're going to fix it. They wouldn't do it. And I was the other fool analyst who was with me at the time in the room said, I thought you were going to go over the table at them. And I'm like, people don't like to be lied to. I hate to be lied to. If you're wrong, that's great. It's fine. But don't lie to my face. And then the pièce de résistance was, you know, they had been buying stock back at the previous quarters at like $25 or whatever. The stock at this point is now $8. And they'd stopped it. So, of course, I asked the ever popular, well, you liked it at 25. Why don't you like it at 8? Oh, well, you know, and I'm like, and then, you know, but then the CEO said, oh, but we're undervalued. We're undervalued. I'm like, well, how do you determine undervalued? Because I'm like, oh, so that implies you have a pricing mechanism for your own stock that somehow triggered at 25, but not at 8. And then he goes, oh, price to earnings to growth. And which, you know, we all know is the PEG ratio. And their PEG ratio's got some certain flaws. And I'm like, the CEO of this company that is burning, just tell me they make their stock buyback decisions based on the PEG ratio. That may have been when the other analyst grabbed my forearm and said, don't. But, you know, like,
that'll disqualify a company.
Well, if I think you're lying to me, I'm done. Because if you're willing to lie to me now, you're willing to lie to me later. You're willing to lie to everyone else. And so if I think you're lying to me, we're finished. And then the other one was, we've already alluded to it. When management calls you, sometimes can be, you know, okay, you're trying to get a very specific story out there. I am thinking of one company. It was Canadian. It was cross-listed Canada and the US at the time. Again, not making mention of any names. They had had a really difficult quarter. They'd been cash flow positive before that. They turned into a surprise cash flow negative thing. And part of that was exacerbated. They were multinational, so they were trading in all various countries. And they were trading, I think, three. The stock was trading in three countries, but they were doing multinational. And they had a $4 million or $5 million loss on, like, just someone didn't hedge. And the CFO called me personally at home to tell me, well, the guy who was responsible for that, yeah, we fired him. Like, you're the CFO. Aren't you responsible for that? Like, where does the buck stop? What was on Harry Truman's desk again? Where does the buck stop? I think it should stop with you, dude. But so again, like these kinds of things, when I feel I'm being misled or I'm being told a story that might not jive with what I think I'm seeing, that's going to get me out. And I haven't even said cash flows. Todd?
No, I agree. I mean, I think it's admitting mistakes is a superpower. And one of the reasons it is a superpower is that I think to be an entrepreneur or to be a leader, you have to have this almost blind faith and confidence in yourself. And so to admit mistakes is even more challenging when you're the one in charge, because you're supposed to give off this aura of strength and confidence all the time. And I think a lot of, especially founder CEOs who have, you know, grown multi-billion dollar businesses, they're not used to hearing they're wrong. Everybody around them is telling them how great they are and their stocks keeps going up and everything. And then as soon as it doesn't, they go, wait, I'm making a mistake? You're telling me I'm making a mistake? And so I have plenty of stories. I mean, one situation, and I liked how Jim said, you know, once I think you're being unethical, I'm out, or lying to me, I'm out. We had a situation, I was part of a stock, and, you know, we got out for those reasons, and stock went on to multibag. And that's really hard because you think, you know, did I make a mistake in doing that? And the stock has since come back down to earth since then. But sometimes you don't get that positive feedback right away. It can take a long time. And that's one of the troubles of being a long-term investor, is the feedback loop is so long. But I agree that, you know, you should be able to sleep at night with every single person you're invested behind. And that we talked about August Trundle earlier with, you know, having a value mindset. Having a CEO like that is just incredible, because you can sleep at night knowing that they're waking up in the morning going, how can I make this business better? And you don't have to do all the legwork yourself. You can outsource it to them.
Yeah. Jim, you mentioned, or wrote to me in the chat here, you have another example you want to talk on. I remember it was one that we covered. It was kind of a COVID story, Fulgent Genetics. Very, would say maybe not a hairy situation, but there was a lot of moving parts there. So what do you have to add to the table with that one?
Well, Fulgent Genetics is one you can go look up in real time. And not going to make me popular for a few people looking at this one, but Fulgent is in this weird spot where the stock today is around $21 or $22. The company has $28 per share in cash on the balance sheet and net cash, so ahead of their debt, and they are cash flow generative. Whoa. This shouldn't happen, right? You know, this is a situation that should not happen. I mean, Mr. Efficient Market should at least be carrying this at $28. I mean, they're literally ascribing negative value to the business. And part of me wonders why they don't take the company private. But, you know, you can use the company's own cash flows and, you know, the CEO and founder is still there. It's got the hallmarks. It's got the hallmarks of a lot of things that, you know, I think I would look for in hidden gems that I think Todd has talked about here. And then I know in Todd's past work, he's also praised. You know, it's not a 1% insider ownership. I think the CEO owns 20 or 25%. But this was a recommendation in my service until I saw what happened. And then, you know, Todd, you know, says, to paraphrase what you just said, you know, I see this, I'm out. When they IPO'd in 2016, they took the genetics business public. I think it was 2016 they IPO'd. They took the genetics business public and they had genetic testing things. And then during COVID, they stood up a COVID testing business, which just sent them to the moon and generated all that cash. So that's largely gone now. But the core business is still there and it's still growing and it's still, you know, it's by all accounts doing well. But about a year and a half ago, out of nowhere, the company announced they were acquiring Fulgent Pharma, which was a private business with a same name. Kind of curious. I wonder who they were acquiring that business from. Any guesses? Right? Like if you said the CEO, Gold Star head of the class. They basically bought the stuff they did in IPO. He bought it from himself. And this business allegedly is going to be a cash consumer, but it's less than the cash generating from the other part of the business. But everything about this screamed self-dealing. There were three members of the board who'd been there. It was a very small board anyway. There was only five members. But there were three members, the CEO and these two other guys who'd been there since day one. They both resigned. One of the guys who also came replace one of them, he lasted 2 months. And I would, again, read your proxy statements, observe, like look for little things, because our informational advantage comes from, it ain't going to come from reading the same balance sheet and income statement everyone else's, right? But a little thing like when you have three directors resign in a very short period of time, two of which have been there since day one and one of which replaced one of the guys who resigned. Oh, you know, read the announcements where they talk about them leaving. Okay, and there's usually a boilerplate thing of some kind of, you know, their resignation was not due to any disagreement with the company on matters, blah, blah, blah. You know, very boilerplate crap, right? Well, the third one of those director resignations, all of these happened before this little, you know, self-dealing deal was announced. The third guy, the first two guys got that boilerplate. The third guy didn't. I wonder why. I'm just making it's an implication. Just making an inference, right? But it looked like self-dealing. There's a bunch of other stuff that's going on there where the CEO is, you know, giving himself multiple one-time exemptions. Yes, I know, multiple one-time exemptions. Doesn't really, sounds a little Orwellian. You know, from the hedging and pledging. So he can like, you know, sell his stock on a prepaid forward, get the money, but he gets to keep voting them. And I just said, you know what? There's a lot going on here. And I think when I wrote the sell rec, I think I even said, look, I'm probably going to look stupid here, but I don't trust these guys anymore. Here's why I don't trust these guys anymore. I've given you a taste of it. I'm out. And I think that's a good example. Like once you're, you know, and it made money for GEMS members. But what I thought was interesting, I think we sold it at 36. And again, today, and at the time I was like, I'm selling at 36 when they have $28 or $29 a share in cash. Like I'm going to look dumb, but I don't trust these guys. What I wasn't expecting was the stock to fall 30, 40% down to 21 or 22. And I'm like, okay, clearly the market, I think, is agreeing with me at this point. The market is saying, yeah, there's something wrong here.
Okay, we've gone kind of into the nitty-gritty details. As we close in on an hour here, I want to go back up to the high-level stuff. What I think a good way for the listeners to maybe get their dip their toe into looking at, you know, small cap value, flyover stocks, hidden gems, is to understand maybe what sectors to go after. Because I know that, again, we've harped on this time and time again, you know, the stuff that's covered on CNBC might be NVIDIA, Magnificent Seven, Palantir, all those stuff that a lot of people are reading about, a lot of people are buying, but there's thousands of other companies that's no one's covering. And it might be overwhelming at the start to say, okay, well, I have this giant list. Where should I go? And I think I'm curious, what sectors come to mind when I ask, what's a flyover stock? Industrials, chemicals, I don't know, anything. Todd, maybe you go first.
You know, I get my ideas from a lot of different sources. It's not just screening. You know, I have a subscription to local business journals. You can buy access to nationwide local business journals. And once in a while, I'll just flip through them and look at the front pages for each city. And you'll see something like Company X is adding 3,000 jobs to the local area. Let's take a look, right? That won't show up in the Wall Street Journal, but it'll show up in the local business journal or, you know, the Omaha journal, because that's impactful. And when a company is adding 3,000 jobs, usually means they expect to grow. And so that's something I start to look at. And so sometimes things come from screens. Sometimes things come from just word of mouth or something I'll read, and or I'll do work on one company and see they have this competitor that's doing something interesting and dig into them. And from in terms of sectors, most of the companies that I find tend to be, I would say industrial tends to be the common, the most frequent that you'll see in the Midwest. Naturally so. I mean, that's logistics and manufacturing. It's kind of the heart of or the country in terms of that. So you're going to find a lot more of that. So to be careful with those, you have to understand, you have to have a good feeling for what mid-cycle earnings look like. If you're going to invest in a company that has cyclical demand, either for their business or their customer's business, you have to understand what mid-cycle earnings looks like before you can comfortably invest. Consumer, sometimes you'll find something like Windmark or Tractor Supply that'll pop up once in a while. And those are great because they're growing store count very rapidly, but it's not on the coast yet. And so the analysts aren't seeing it. They can maybe not relate to it. Like Boot Barn. I don't know enough about Boot Barn, but I've heard good things about it. So I'll take a look at that one too. But really there's anything. It's just maybe not as much in certain areas. So there are technology companies in the Midwest and outside of major cities. There are banking companies outside of major cities. There are software companies. Like, you know, MedPace is a healthcare company based in Cincinnati, and they've got operations all over the world. So you can find things by, you know, the sectors. I would say it's probably weighted towards industrials or industrial services, but you can find just about anything if you keep looking.
Jim?
I mean, I got a lot of thoughts about. I like to throw a really wide net. If you're looking for people who, well, first of all, if people want to find flyover stocks or hidden gems, may I suggest subscribing to a flyover stocks Substack or a Hidden Gems Canada service? I'm just, you know, we'll find them for you. But you know, I'd like to do a lot of screening. I like what Todd said earlier. I'm going to paraphrase what you said a little bit, but you're not a recommendation service. You're finding businesses that, hey, this looks interesting. Educate yourself now, so when it, you know, when the price is right, you can maybe jump in. I love that philosophy. There are stocks that I found 15 years ago that I've recommended in the last year, but I've just kind of watched them and, you know, watch how they grow up, watch what they do. I may or may not take a small starter position. I think those are important, just to, you know, so you know, like, I'm talking 0.1% of your portfolio, but just like, okay, it forces me to keep watching this. And then you go back 6 months later, like, why do I own this again? What the hell? But that's just me. But you know, like, I like some very basic screening, you know, which there are tools out there. You can search around for tools, but like, one of the screens I do is I do a size screen, you know, like, and again, cause I'm searching for small. So it's generally, you know, under $4 billion, maybe above 250 million. And I do very basic financial screens, right? Like, has to be cash flow positive on an operating basis. Okay. Because funny thing is, in the spirit of admitting you're wrong is a superpower, my two worst recommendations in Hidden Gems Canada. Okay. Both down 90%+. Like, just, I did a terrible job with these. And I, all I can do is say I'm sorry and tell you what I'm going to learn from my mistakes. Both were cash flow negative. Doesn't mean that every cash flow negative doesn't mean a company can't have a cash flow negative quarter, but, like, you know, cash flow negativity blows up on you if you're persistently cash flow negative, you know, which, you know, think about a few of the names that IPO'd in the 2020, 2021 mania and go look at their cash flow statements. They might get a lot of play on CNBC, but I ain't going to look at them. So basic cash flow. And then I like to say, okay, so cash, positive cash flow, positive free cash flow, very simple, you know, like cash from operations, less CapEx. Is it greater than 10%? Is cash flow from operations greater than net income, which suggests a higher quality of earnings? What's their leverage look like? Want to keep the leverage below a certain level? And then just look, you know, like I said, I'm not enamored of super, super, super rapid growth. I don't care, frankly. I love companies that are growing 5 to 7% because people discount them. And if it's run by someone who gets it, to go back to our theme, you know, 5 to 7% top line growth might end up being, you know, 10 to 12% operating profit growth, may end up being 13 to 15% earnings per share growth because they've done things there. But so that, you know, I would urge people, if you have an interest in this kind of stuff, to get comfortable with, like, those types of little screening. And then, you know, and then, yeah, look outside the areas where people are really excited. Like, I'm going to give Todd a flyover stock here, unless it's one, he's probably already knows it. But if you don't know it, I'll throw one at you. Have you ever looked at CAS Information Systems?
I have not.
So they are a payment and information processing company. So, you know, a little bit something sexy, right? Right. We like payments companies. We like processing companies, but, like, they're out of St. Louis, Missouri. They've got a bank stock on them, but what their payments and logistics are, it's for the trucking industry. It's very mundane. Their bank is very mundane, and their banking clients. And this is, again, like, you know, I always like absurd stories, because you can make money in absurd stories. Their niches are just run-of-the-mill banking in St. Louis and their home turf. So very localized banking. The second is they are the franchising partner for McDonald's. So that helps set you up. And then the third, and this is 40% of their lending. And it's a kind of a crazy, again, it's a stock that very few people have heard of, but no one follows it. 40% of their lending is to church and church-related mortgages and construction. Okay. And I don't care what your religious affiliation may or may not be. I think we can all agree that no one is building churches on spec in order to flip them, right? Like, I think that's probably going to be reasonable lending. So, you know, it's just like you find these stories. And the last point I would say is just immerse yourself in the story, unless you find something that makes you go, I'm out. But, like, you know, I think we often have a little too much ascribed to what we do, or at least what I do. I can summarize most of what I do by saying I read. I'm done. Like, I'm chasing the story. And I think I'm inferring from what Todd said earlier, you know, getting local business journals, you know, what are you doing? You're reading about things that other people, it's not making to Wall Street, it's not making to Silicon Valley. And I think that's an advantage.
All right, let's hit a wrap-up question. Kind of a quick closing one, two-parter for each of you guys. I'd say, what's one thing you want listeners to take away from? And then to add on, where can any listeners find your work? Todd, let's start with you.
Sure, you can find my work at flyoverstocks.com on Substack. Follow me on Twitter at Todd Wenning. I would say what I would ask you to do if you're interested in sort of flyover stocks or hidden gems is just to start turning over rocks. That's the best thing you can possibly do. If you're just starting out as an investor, read as many annual reports as you can get your hands on, read the proxy statements, try to develop some pattern recognition, because I think that's really important for small caps in particular, because once you start identifying certain traits of management teams or companies that are successful. And again, you can go back to history. So you can read about Tractor Supply. You can read about Jack Henry. Start getting those pattern recognition skills in place and then see where it takes you. But it requires a little bit more work than the large cap space because not as much analysis is being done for you. But I find that most interesting as an investor personally.
All right, Jim.
I'm going to largely echo what Todd said. Read broadly, get interested. There's going to be no substitute for passion. And bluntly, if you don't have passion for finding your own stocks, look, dollar cost averaging in index funds is a perfectly acceptable way to probably beat a lot of active investors, bluntly. But you know, I you can find me at Fool Canada, at Hidden Gems Canada, if anyone wants. I'm going to do a shameless plug. Sorry. But you know, you can feel free to send me an email at jgillies@fool.com and I'll send you a new member pricing link if you want to kick the tires. And I'm also on Twitter at Jim P. Gillies, because apparently I wasn't fast enough to get my name without the middle initial. but like what I would hope that listeners are going to take away from here is the passion for doing this. That I have, that I certainly know Todd has, because yeah, we've known each other for a while. And I love the intellectual challenge of finding a company, and especially because I work for a larger organization that's got, you know, however many services the Motley Fool now has, you know, catering to all these different, you know, and so we will, for our compliance stuff, we'll put in a ticker, you know, have to reserve it so no one in the company can trade on it and blah, blah, blah. And that's good and wonderful. But I've had a number of times where I put the ticker in and it's not in the system because no one at the company has ever looked at the company before. You can't do that with Apple. You can't do that with NVIDIA. Yeah, you might be able to do it with MedPace or CAS Information Systems or Windmark, right? You know, where and when you find these things and you find them for a number of times, you find them over a number of years, and you see them clocking 15, 20, 25% annualized returns from wherever you started looking at them, especially like I mentioned, you know, with Tractor Supply, going back to when Todd was looking at it and when I was stupidly just putting it as a watch list company, cheated myself out of 25% annual gains, you know, so it's just, you know, read widely, be curious, turn over rocks, as Todd says, think long-term and have fun with it. And if you're not, and if you don't want to have fun with it, again, if you think of it as work, there's nothing wrong with dollar cost averaging into indexes. So.
All right. That's a great way to wrap. For anyone interested, there will be the links to both of these places directly in the show notes to make it easy for anyone that really wants to check it out right now. But let me hit the disclosure. We are not financial advisors. Anything we say on the show is not formal advice or recommendation. Ryan, I, or any podcast guest may hold securities discussed in this podcast. They've held them in the past and may buy, sell, or hold them in the future. Thank you, Jim and Todd, for joining the show today, and we'll see you next time.